Your Honors, may it please the court, I am Zena Crenshaw representing the plaintiff, the appellant Marietta Taylor. It's tempting for me to belabor the factual background explaining why this case got remanded to state court before the plaintiff formally amended her complaint. And it's tempting because the defendants, the appellees, keep emphasizing that the federal complaint never got amended, and it presently seeks to vacate a state court judgment, which is true.
Do you know what interests me, Ms. Crenshaw? You originally filed this action in state court. Why are you resisting a return to state court?
Well, Your Honor, we're resisting it because it's been remanded on improper grounds as far as we can see. We believe that there's been a misapplication of the Rooker-Feldman doctrine.
And what difference does that make? If you go back to the court where you went in the first place, I don't understand why you don't just go back there and carry on.
Well, whether we end up litigating this case in state or our federal court, it's just very important that it's not skewed, the process is not skewed or jeopardized by a misapplication of that Rooker-Feldman doctrine. You see, the problem is the court not only made a determination that it was compelled to remand the state court case, the case back to state court, it went on to say that Taylor had a reasonable opportunity to present her claim to the state court. And that it reaches that conclusion under the Rooker-Feldman doctrine, but the broad stroke of this brush has Ms. Taylor arguably postured to have her case dismissed in state court under the doctrine of issue preclusion. And that is, if we were simply going back to state court unhindered, we wouldn't be as concerned about the outcome of the trial court's decision.
Well, now, help me and tell me if I'm wrong here, because to me, it seems that all of the things that were alleged in the complaint were known at the time of the foreclosure proceeding, and thus could have been raised as defenses to foreclosure. Why weren't those issues raised then?
Well, Your Honor, I think that brings out a very important aspect of this case, because it's the plaintiff's contention that it was the defendant's obligation to cease and desist with this conduct that resulted in the judgment of foreclosure against us. And that is going to be one of, I believe, an issue of first impression for this case as to whether, in fact, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act compelled the defendant to regardless of the plaintiff's action, to not proceed to discriminate against her. And then we're also enforcing that contention by citing U.S. Supreme Court precedents, which I don't have a citation with me today, but the court has taken the position that a private party cannot seek to wield the power of the state in order to effectuate a denial of equal protection under the law. So these are issues that ultimately are going to have to be addressed by a state or federal court, and if the Rooker-Feldman doctrine had been properly applied in this case, it would be done in federal court. This is an important case. It tests the reach of the Equal Credit Opportunity Act in an unprecedented way that could revolutionize the mortgage industry to some extent and solidify some protection for some of our country's most vulnerable citizens when it comes to credit transactions. One interesting question that's going to be presented in this case is whether, in fact, it is discrimination to declare a mortgagor in default and foreclose on her mortgage after 20 years because the public assistance agency that's helping her, that's paying her mortgage, doesn't put its payment procedures in compliance with her private mortgage agreement. So this is a case that's going to have some far-reaching implications in analysis of federal law, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act. And whether that's done in state or federal court, we particularly don't want to be postured for dismissal in both courts because the court went too far in making determinations under the Rooker-Feldman doctrine. Our reply brief recounts the relevant history as to why this case, why we did not amend our complaint to eliminate our efforts to vacate the state court judgment. But the trial court actually allowed for this set of circumstances when it explained, even if Taylor's claim was couched differently, we still would be constrained to find her federal cases inextricably intertwined with the state foreclosure judgment. Well, we won't be constrained to make that finding if this court is prepared to concur with the Tenth Circuit, at least as they have expressed themselves in the Noel versus Hall case that we cited. And Ms. Taylor has an opportunity to amend her federal complaint to preclude any forbidden de facto appeal. And she can do that. We don't have to set aside the judgment of foreclosure against Ms. Taylor in order to make her whole. It just doesn't have to be done. The issue is what, just as the court can point out that we started in state court, and so why are we working so hard to stay in federal court, we can emphasize that we were in state court and the defendants removed us to federal court and also made an argument that it was their right under federal law to have this case tried in federal court, regardless of the theory, state or federal, on which the complaint was brought. And now they are insisting that we remain in state court. So what's most important, well, we would, given the importance of the federal issues in this case, the plaintiff would like to see it addressed in our federal courts because of the far-reaching implications of the federal law that has to be interpreted for the first time. But we particularly want the trial court stretch in applying the Rooker-Feldman doctrine. We want that to be limited so that we don't find ourselves having our discussion of fraud on the court and other state court theories taken away because the federal court has already determined that all of this could have been brought up during the in defense of the foreclosure judgment, which is a strategy that the appellees have already initiated in state court. I'll wait for my rebuttal.
Thank you, counsel. Right.
If it please the court, I'm Catherine Schmidt, and I'm representing Burke, Costanza, and Cuppy, one of the appellees in this matter. I am today with co-counsel that represents Fannie Mae and Waterfield, and we are splitting our argument so there is no duplication. I will be addressing the basics of the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine and its application to this case. Burke, Costanza, and Cuppy is the law firm that initiated the foreclosure on behalf of Waterfield and Fannie Mae. When this case was filed, Burke, Costanza joined in the removal on the basis that Fannie Mae is a federal agency, and there were the claims of the Equal Credit Opportunity Act and Section 1985 claims, believing that those were federal, it could be in the federal court. After briefing the motion to dismiss and the court raised the issue of Rooker-Feldman, Burke, Costanza, and Cuppy have to concede that it applies and that it was a mistake to take it to the federal court and it should have remained in the state court.
If Ms. Taylor had requested damages instead of requesting that the state court judgment be vacated, would there be a Rooker-Feldman issue here?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe there would be on the basis that she did, because at some point in her complaint, although she asked even in the title for it to be vacated, later she said she's either entitled to recover her home or the value of it. So knowing that it's possible she couldn't get the home back, she would have wanted the damages, as you mentioned, for the value of that home. So because it all stemmed from the foreclosure action, it still would have been precluded.
Well, I think that's inextricably intertwined, which is a rather metaphysical thing that we have to deal with here. But and I think that the compensatory damages is tied in with the mortgage foreclosure, but how about the punitive damages? Does she have an independent claim to punitive damages based on the Equal Credit Act?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because your initial question is her action seeking to set it aside, or is it independent? everything she asked for, even under the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, stemmed from the foreclosure. She even stated...
Well, that's true of everything except the punitive damages. I'm not sure that that's explicitly tied to the foreclosure anyway.
Well, the question becomes, even for punitive damages, there has to be the initial injury and compensation for it, and then punitive damages are allowed, even if they're allowed under the Act. On that basis, her injury stems from the foreclosure. I don't care whether it is the punitive or compensatory. Without the foreclosure...
I suppose she could have claimed some other injury, but she apparently didn't. Is that something that amounts to?
Well, Your Honor...
I don't know what other injuries she could have endured, but I assume there are some of them she could have claimed for as a result of discriminatory action.
Well, I think this issue of independent, which the court... this court has dealt with on numerous occasions, goes back to the idea of whether the injury was complete with the state court entering the judgment or whether it was an injury suffered out of court that wasn't relieved by the court. All of her injury stems from the state court foreclosure. There isn't any way to separate them. So we believe that this case is distinguished from both Long v. the Lakeshore Bank and Brokaw v. Weaver, which the appellant cite, because the foreclosure proceedings, in fact, are the violation she claims for the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, and it is the conspiracy for which she claims damages under 1985. Therefore, we believe there was no independent violation of her rights, and that there's nothing except the foreclosure judgment, which she is requesting to either be vacated or damages because of it. This is a de facto appeal, which is banned by the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine, and we believe the case should stay in the state court.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Michael H. Mishmerheisen. I represent Waterfield and Fannie Mae. I want to pick up where my co-appellee left off and say that although the Rooker-Feldman does obviously bar a review by a federal court of a state court judgment, it also bars claims that are inextricably intertwined, as she stated, and that is, as you mentioned, Your Honor, a sort of metaphysical concept. But the district court here, I believe, did a very nice job of finding cases that were similar and analogous, and as well as distinguishing cases cited by the appellant. As far as Noel versus Hall, I believe that is a Ninth Circuit decision, and in that case, the wrongs asserted in federal court were wrongs that were committed by the opposing party, wrongs that were complete when they were done by the opposing party, not the state court judgment. The appellant in this case alleges some wrongs that were allegedly committed by her opposing party, by the defendants in that federal action, but those wrongs were only complete upon the judgment of the state of the foreclosure action. And I believe that is the definition, if there can be one, of inextricably intertwined. There are some other cases cited. Appellant kind of avoided the question of whether she had a reasonable opportunity to present these claims in court. Claims cannot be inextricably intertwined if she had a reasonable opportunity to present them in the state court proceeding. Not whether it was difficult to do so, but whether she was prevented by some means from presenting those claims. I think if you look at the Long case, which is a case out of this court, in that case, the plaintiff in the defendant in the state court action, the plaintiff in the federal court action, kind of an egregious case. She was lied to by the opposing counsel, who told her to sign something that would continue the foreclosure action or kind of make things right. And it was actually a consent decree, a consent judgment. And so the defendant in that state action never got the opportunity to go into court. Also, the Illinois state law in that case forbid bringing any extrinsic matters as counterclaims or as defenses.
Would a violation of the Equal Credit Opportunity Act be a defense to foreclosure?
I believe so, Your Honor, the appellant has alleged that she was discriminated against in a credit transaction. Interestingly, in her complaint, she said that the credit transaction was a foreclosure proceedings. In her briefs in this court, she says that a state court could not enforce a judgment that constituted a violation of the Equal Credit Opportunity Act. And so if she had been able to prove that claim, if she had presented it, and if she had been able to prove it, I believe that it would have been a defense to the foreclosure action. As far as Brokaw, another case recently out of this court, the defendant in the state court action was a minor who was removed from her home. And in that case, she was truly unable to present her. She did not have the reasonable opportunity to present her claims in the state court action because she was a minor. She was not there in custody of the state. And she was not represented by counsel or guardian ad litem. So in that case, the defendant in the state court action or a party in the state court action truly did not have a reasonable opportunity to present her claims in the state court action. In this case, the appellant has never explained why she did not present, as the panel mentioned, why she did not present those claims in the state court action. That is a bar to her now bringing those claims under the Rooker-Feldman Act. Your Honors, I think if you examine the decision of the district court, I think you'll find that it's correct. I think you'll find that the cases that the district court relied on out of this circuit are factually indistinguishable, are analogous, are applicable. The plaintiff's claims are based on a state court judgment because had there been no judgment of foreclosure, there would be no damages. There'd be no Equal Credit Opportunity Act violation alleged. There would be no Title VII civil rights violations alleged. Everything began, the damages began at the time that the state court entered its foreclosure order. And that, to attack it now in federal court, is clearly a violation of the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine. And unless your honors have any further questions, Waterfield and Fannie Mae respectfully request that the district court judgment be affirmed in all respects.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Pardon me.
Your Honor, the appellees make a good point. The plaintiff has never had an opportunity to explain to the federal court why these defenses were not presented in response to the foreclosure action. It was remanded before those determinations can be made, and it was remanded sort of with the notion that she should have done it, and therefore her rights have been foreclosed, and that's the little attachment to the remand order that creates the big problem for us. And Appellee is absolutely right. We have never had our chance in federal court to deal with that issue, where it already seems to have been resolved by the federal trial court. The appellees confuse me at times because I guess that's just the nature of trying to grapple with the Rooker-Feldman Doctrine. Just when you think you got it, something confuses you. Just when you think you understand a person's analysis of it, it gets all murky. But it's been my understanding that their contention has been all along, if we had not asked that the state court judgment be vacated, we could be in federal court. And it's just instinctual. We thought that this should be handled in state court, that it was primarily about a foreclosure, so we went to state court and we asked for all the relief we thought she was entitled to. Once we got to federal court, we rethought it, we considered the implications of the federal issues, and we represented to the trial court that we would be willing to vacate our quest to get the state court judgment set aside, and we should be able to stay in state court. the fact is this circuit has already determined that even if Ms. Taylor would not have suffered, well, in analogous decisions, even if Ms. Taylor would not have suffered any damages absent the state order of foreclosure, her claim is not barred by the Rooker-Feldman doctrine because her claim of damages is based on an alleged independent violation of her federal civil rights. Now, that has been determined already. The appellees may not think that's good law. They may disagree with it, but that is the law. And we should be able to stay in federal court and certainly not be hampered by a federal court decision that's haunting us right now in state court. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank both of you. We will take the case on.